Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Lisa Bortolotti. She is professor of philosophy at the University of Birmingham, affiliated with the philosophy department in the School of Philosophy, Theology, and Religion, and with the Institute for Mental Health in the School of Psychology. Her research is in the philosophy of the cognitive sciences, and she's the author of The Epistemic Innocence of Rational Beliefs, which we're going to talk about today. So, Dr. Bortolotti, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, great. So, let's start with some basic concepts. Since the book is about the epistemic innocence of irrational beliefs, what is an irrational belief?
Okay, that's a good question because philosophers often mean different things by rational and irrational. In the book, I focus on one form of irrationality, which is epistemic irrationality. And that's the type of irrationality that has to do with the relationship between the content of the belief and the evidence that the person who has the belief has in support of that content. So a belief is epistemically rational when we adopt that belief because we have evidence that suggests that the content might be true. And also, we are kind of responsive to evidence against the belief that might come up after we have adopted the belief. So, if we do get counter evidence and we are being epistemically irrational, then what we do is ask ourselves whether we need to suspend judgment or to revise the belief. So, we are to some extent responsive to evidence that becomes available even after the adoption of the belief. So in the book, I focus on the beliefs that fail to satisfy at least one of those features, responsiveness to evidence or being well supported by evidence.
So would you say that then we have different types of rationality and irrationality? Because since you're focusing on the book in the book on epistemic irrationality, then we should have different types, right?
Yeah, so my understanding of the literature, anyway, is that when people focus on beliefs, epistemic rationality and irrationality is the notion that they have in mind, because we tend to think of beliefs as the type of mental state that has this kind of special relationship with evidence. But you are absolutely right that there are other forms of irrationality which apply to beliefs as well. So, one example would be what I call procedural rationality. So a belief is procedurally rational when it's kind of well integrated in the system of beliefs with the other beliefs that are part of that system. So there is overall coherence, for instance, or even better, the beliefs kind of support each other. And a problem with procedural rationality may emerge if beliefs conflict or whether there is even an inconsistency in the belief system. Another type of irrationality, which I think is relevant to beliefs, is what I call agential irrationality. And that's when you've got a belief and you're quite committed to the content of the belief, but in your own behavior, you don't manifest your commitment to the belief. And the belief doesn't drive action in the way that we would expect it to drive action. So, in that sense, there is some kind of mismatch between, your verbal behavior, so the fact that you verbally commit to the content of the belief being true, and your non-verbal behavior, the fact that you don't seem, your behavior doesn't reflect your commitment to the belief.
I think that in the book you mention another term, another concept that is connected with the thesis of your book. What is epistemic functionality? Because that is not exactly the same as epistemic rationality in the case, right?
Yes, so whereas epistemic rationality and irrationality is a common notion in the literature and many people write about it, especially by reference to beliefs, epistemic functionality is something I have introduced in the book. And that's the idea that a belief might help you pursue your epistemic goals. with a view of fulfilling them. That is not the same, as you say, very rightly say, as epistemic rationality, because my view is that even in some cases, even a belief that is not epistemically rational can actually be epistemically helpful when we're thinking about functionality. Because it may be that even a belief that is not well supported by evidence may actually play a special role in our mental economy and make us more likely to fulfill some of our epistemic goals. Now, you may wonder, what do you mean by epistemic goals? And I think that's a very good question, because unless we understand what the epistemic goals are, it's not very clear what epistemic functionality does. So an epistemic goal at a kind of a higher level would be attain information that is relevant to me. Get to know things that I need to know in order to function well in the world and to coordinate with other people. Another epistemic goal could be retain that information so that I can actually use it when the appropriate time comes. And my idea is that epistemic functionality is interesting, even if my impression is that epistemologists don't tend to focus on it, because it brings together standard epistemic concerns, such as, you know, attaining true information, with things that are a little bit more practical and psychological. So what actually an agent needs to be like in order to pursue and fulfill those goals. So it makes the whole enterprise of thinking about attaining and retaining true information more, I guess, psychologically realistic, more embedded in, you know, the type of agents that we are, with the limitations that we find ourselves with.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. Would that mean then that we need some form of epistemic irrationality for us to be able to seek the truth?
Okay, so I understand that that might sound very counterintuitive. And indeed, when I was developing the idea of epistemic innocence, people had the same tone of disbelief that you just had. So how is it possible, right, that we need epistemic irrationality in order to be good epistemic agents? I do agree that that's counterintuitive. I do see that there is a strong link between epistemically rational beliefs and the fulfillment and the successful pursuit of epistemic goals. So standardly, I think truth, rationality, and functionality go together. That's the way that we want it to be. That said, it's more likely that that's the way it's going to be if we are ideal agents, and we are not. So that's my starting point, that human agents are very successful in what they do, given their capacities and their limitations. But their limitations mean that sometimes they need to make sure that some things are happening and only an irrational belief can get them there. In particular, I'm thinking about motivation. In order to pursue goals that we care about, we need to continue to care about them until we have actually fulfilled them. And we need to have the capacity to bounce back when there are obstacles and adversities that initially suggest that we may not be able to attain those goals. And in order to have that kind of, we may call it resilience, we sometimes need to have a conception of ourselves or a conception of the world that is slightly distorted in a positive way. So we may think, you know, I'm really excellent at this. I know I had a setback, but look, I will try again. And, you know, I have a chance of succeeding. And I think in order to have this motivation, we may sometimes have this kind of inflated conception of ourselves that is not accurate, is not realistic, but gives us that capacity to say, okay, this is not the end of the story. I still have a possibility. I want to pursue that possibility. So that's just one example of how sometimes a belief that is not accurate and for which maybe we don't have sufficient evidence can actually help us do something that may be good eventually in the long run, even from an epistemic point of view.
Mm-hmm. But would that apply simply to practical situations in terms of how we lead our lives and the goals we want to obtain? Or would it also apply to seeking the truth with a capital T, like, for example, philosophers and scientists would have it?
That's an interesting question. I can, in the book, I don't make a distinction really between these two different contexts in which we are pursuing epistemic goals. But I do agree that different contexts might call for different types of behavior. And that's a point that actually I do try to make in the book, although it's often more implicit than explicit. By that, I mean that the particular point that I'm making, that even an irrational belief can be epistemically useful, is definitely a point that cannot be generalized to a number of different contexts in which the agent finds herself. I think it's a point that needs always to be assessed relative to the situation, the particular situation in which the agent is. Because the same belief for the same agent may be in some context a really good belief to have from the perspective of, you know, let's say maintaining the motivation to pursue epistemic goals, and a really bad belief to have in a different situation. So it may be that when we're doing philosophy in our philosophy seminar and we're trying to establish the truth of something, then having an epistemically irrational belief is not helping. But, you know, I don't know, trying to find our way around the city and asking people at the marketplace, you know, in that context, it might work. But I don't think that the idea is that, I mean, at least I don't have any strong intuition that in the context in which we're seeking the truth with the capital T, epistemically irrational beliefs are always bad. I think you can have it either way, depending on what is it that you're doing and what you need the irrational belief for. But I also want to say one more thing that might make people a little bit more relaxed around the idea of epistemic innocence, which is that the way I see it, the epistemically rational belief is still our goal, is still our aspiration. So if we could choose, that's how I want to put it, we would always choose an epistemically rational belief over an epistemically irrational belief if their consequences were the same. What I see the epistemically irrational belief as doing is being some sort of ladder, right? So we need it for the time being until we are in an epistemic situation where we can replace it with a more epistemically rational belief. So again, you know, I'm not disparaging rationality. I'm not thinking that rationality is not our aspiration. I think it is. It remains our aspiration. I'm just saying that the way that we get there, that we get to the truth with the capital T, may be a little bit more tortuous than we initially think. Instead of being on a straight line, where we just kind of reject any form of irrationality until we get to where we want to be, we may actually need some irrationality along the way to help us. But once we got to the place where we want to be, we can try and do without with the irrational, try to do without the irrationality. At least that's the hope.
So in the book, when you get to defining what is epistemic innocence, you mentioned three criteria, and we've already talked about two of them, about epistemic irrationality and epistemic benefits in a way. The third one is that there are no alternatives to those same epistemically irrational beliefs. Could you explain that?
Yes, so as you said very, very nicely, epistemic innocence comes with these three conditions. It's a notion that applies only to epistemically rational beliefs, and we saw that a belief can be epistemically rational either if it is ill-grounded or if it is irresponsive to evidence. Some beliefs are both ill-grounded and irresponsive to evidence. The second condition is that the belief has some significant epistemic benefit for the subject at that time. And the third condition is that there is no better way of getting to that benefit. So there is no less epistemically irrational belief that that is available to the subject at that time. So that's the idea that I was just describing a moment ago, that if we could choose between an epistemically rational belief that has some epistemic benefits and an epistemically irrational belief that has the same benefits, we of course go for the epistemic rational belief. Why? Well, because the epistemically irrational belief always has epistemic costs as well as benefits. And if we can do without the costs, of course we want to do that. But sometimes my claim is that's not possible. This impossibility needs to be unpacked. So sometimes it's not possible just because, as kind of standard, statistically normal human agents, we have got some limitations. Our memory is limited. Our capacity, let's say, for reasoning is limited. Our deductive abilities are limited. Our capacity to get evidence sometimes is not perfect as well. Our capacity to process information is not perfect. But also there are other forms of limitations. For instance, some of us have some kind of mental struggle that makes it even harder to fulfill our kind of epistemic duties and achieve our epistemic goals. So there are some kind of memory impairments that people with amnesia or dementia might have, which prevent them from accessing information about themselves, for instance, and so on. So because of these limitations, either completely statistically normal limitations that we all share, and limitations that may come with particular impairments that some people have at some stages of their life, we may not be able to get to those epistemic benefits in the best possible way, so via the epistemically rational beliefs. So what we do is sometimes we use epistemically rational beliefs. That's not a conscious choice, that's just what happens. But because it is important to me that it is very clear that an epistemically rational belief would be better if possible. It is also important to say that this third condition is essential to epistemic innocence. And also it makes it very clear that the context is important, because in different contexts, there will be different alternatives to the epistemically rational belief. And that's why sometimes the epistemically rational belief is innocent, because in that context, there is no alternative to choose from. And in other contexts, it will not be innocent, because there will be alternatives that the agent can choose. And you know, the agent should have a preference for the epistemically rational belief in that particular context. So that's how I see the no alternative condition. One thing that I guess it's important to qualify is that I'm not meaning the notion of availability as strict availability all the time. So in some cases, let's say that I've got dementia and I cannot access information about my past. In that particular case, a distorted belief about my past may be innocent, because the alternative belief, which is an accurate belief about my past, is not something I can access. So in that case, I think we have a case of strict unavailability. There is nothing really I can do. And because dementia is a progressive illness as well, it's not likely that it will change for the better. If it changes, it will change for the worse. There are other cases where unavailability is less strict. So for instance, it may be that I do have some way of accessing the correct information in some context, but it's just that that's not immediately salient to me. So for instance, I may not understand that that bit of information that is accurate actually is a good explanation for the phenomenon that I'm interested in. And so I dismiss it, or I don't even consider it as a potential source of information. So in that case, that's what we call explanatory unavailability. Something is available to me, but I just don't see the relationship between the information and what I want to believe or what I need to find out. And in other cases, I think even weaker, or possibly just the same level of weakness, but just a weaker notion than strict unavailability, is the idea of motivational unavailability. So that's when the information is available to me, but if I were to consider that information, there would be very significant psychological costs. So suppose that I suspect that my partner is having an affair, right? Now, I have information that might suggest that that's the case, but it's so kind of psychologically costly for me to consider that information that somehow I kind of blank it out. And so that's what some people think is happening in cases of self-deception. It's not the whole story, of course, but it's part of the story. So it's possible that there are also these sources of motivational unavailability that might affect the way in which the information is available to us.
Yeah. So before we run through some more examples, you already gave us some examples that you explore in the book of where epistemic innocence applies. Does it also apply to a context of science and philosophy? Because when you were mentioning availability of information, for example, I mean, philosophy and science, they are ongoing processes of knowledge creation and acquisition of information. So there's not, and there will never be a point in time where we have all the information available for us to, let's say, completely evaluate a given phenomenon, for example. So, would the concept of epistemic innocence also apply in these disciplines?
That's a very good question. When I started out thinking about epistemic innocence, people suggested to me that actually there may be cases that approximate epistemic innocence in the sciences. So, for instance, one idea which I think comes from Swart's work is that sometimes we use models in science. Now, models are not perfectly accurate representations of reality, they are approximations. And we know that. We are aware that, when we're embracing a model, we are not actually describing reality as it is. At the same time, the model seems to be extremely useful in an epistemic way, because what it does, it might have, for instance, heuristic power. It might help us discover other things about reality that we may not have thought about before, or it may increase our understanding of certain phenomenon because it, this is just an example. It could be a simplification of a very complex phenomenon, and by understanding the simplification, we have better chances then to understand the more complex version of it. So it is certainly possible that, the notion of epistemic innocence, possibly with some revisions, will apply, I think, outside the areas of applications that I considered in the book. And I think in science, it is a very appropriate context. I'm also thinking about how some philosophers of science and sociologists of science describe scientific change. And it sounds as if the notions of explanatory unavailability and motivational unavailability may apply there. So it may be that the scientific community is just not ready at some point in time to switch from, let's say, one paradigm to the next, because there are motivational reasons why the scientists do not want to give up the kind of picture of the world that the way of doing science is committed to, or because there is this kind of explanatory mismatch between the new paradigm and the kind of questions that that particular community has started to ask. So it's definitely possible, I think, that some of the mechanisms that I'm describing in the book may be applied, for instance, to the practice of science and the way the science changes.
So, now talking about specific examples, not in a scientific context, but more in a psychological slash cognitive one, what about personal narratives? Do people really need personal narratives to be functional in their lives and to be functional in society? Or is it, because I would imagine that our personal narratives, I mean, they could be one way or the other. I mean, because our memories are not perfect, and because sometimes, I mean, it's a bit self-serving, the kinds of personal narratives that we develop. So, what about that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So, I don't talk a lot about personal narratives in themselves in the book, but you are absolutely right that I often refer to this idea that the human agent has a sense of self. And what that sense of self is, or what the sense of self does, is actually extremely important for epistemic functionality. And one way of thinking about the sense of self is via the narrative. At least there is one narrative aspect to our sense of self. The way I'm thinking about the sense of self, or, as psychologists call it, identity, but for philosophers, sometimes calling it identity is a bit confusing because they think about the metaphysical aspect of identity. But all I mean by that is that the person has some idea of who he or she is, And so, you know, where they were born, who their parents are, what kind of life events characterize them, and so on. And also what type of person they are, you know, whether they are generous or whether they are clever or whether they are lazy. You know, that they have a series of, we may call them beliefs, but they somehow they're kind of self-defining beliefs. They're beliefs about themselves that really help them think about themselves, but also kind of deliberate when they need to make important decisions. They need to think about what type of person they are. You know, will this job be the right job for me? Will this person be the right partner for me? You know, they need to know about themselves in order to make those kind of decisions. But also, it's the way that they present themselves to others. And very often, we have different identities depending on the person that we present ourselves to. We have one identity for our employers and one for our family members, and so on. So this sense of self, I think, is important because we also have a sense of the type of agent that we are. And that, I think, is what is important for epistemic functionality. We need to have a sense of ourselves as largely sensible, coherent, rational agents. That is important because if we do, then we will try and model our behavior so that it can become confirmation of that belief. And so let's say that I think I'm a very generous person. If I want to maintain that concept of myself, the sense of myself as a generous friend, I will try and behave when I can consciously control my behavior as a generous person when I am with my friends, right? So I think that process is important because it ensures to some extent that we have the motivation to fulfill, you know, our epistemic goals, for instance. So if I want to be a rational deliberator, when I make decisions, I will try to make my decision in such a way that they will become evidence for other people to think of me as a rational deliberator. Now, not everybody, of course, agrees that we've got this sense of self that is so important. And also, many people disagree that if we do have a sense of self, it has any kind of narrative structure. Now, I'm not wedded to the idea that there needs to be a very complex and articulated narrative here. So it could be a very simple narrative. It could be, okay, I'm the person, or kind of, this is the typical kind of narrative structure that we offer. For ourselves, to other people, and sometimes to ourselves as well, is what McAdams calls the redemption narrative. No, okay, so I started out and I was poor and disadvantaged and I had nothing, but then I worked really hard, overcame all these obstacles, and now I'm a very successful businessman, right? So that's one type. Or again, you know, my parents were supportive, but I really didn't know what to do, and I was bullied at school, and everything was awful. But look, you know, then I had therapy, and now I'm a very happy person. So we tend to see our lives in this way, that it starts badly, or it starts with kind of obstacles and aspirations, and by the time we mature and develop, we're able to overcome the obstacles and to some extent succeed. So there is this sense of progress, cumulative progress in our lives. And that helps us because when there are setbacks, we integrate them in this narrative and we think, okay, that's just the next hurdle, no? But we will end up successfully. And that's important. Obviously, as you were saying in your question, these narratives are not accurate. They are distorted. It's normal. Like every narrative, some people say every story is fictional. Even historical fiction is fiction, right? Because you've got your angle on things, you've got your interpretation. You emphasize some things and you kind of disemphasize other things. You leave them aside. So all these narratives are to some extent biased and distorted for the reasons that you were mentioning, because our memory is selective, so we tend to remember certain things and to forget other things. And we tend to build this picture of ourselves that is overly positive. And clearly, from the point of view of epistemic rationality, that's not so good, right? Because we have a sense of ourselves that doesn't really correspond to, let's say, the sense of ourselves that other people might have. And so there is this mismatch. A colleague of mine, Anneli Jefferson, for instance, she also thinks that's bad for morality. Because if we are already thinking that we are perfectly generous and lovely, we will not do very much to improve our behavior and become more generous and lovely, right? So there are lots of problems with it, which I acknowledge, I recognize. At the same time, what I want to say is, okay, but look at the benefits. If you do think you are a good agent, who uses a reflection, a capacities for reflection when she makes choices, let's say, then that's what you want to look like. That's what you're going to do when you have the power to control your decisions, when you're not conditioned by external cues or other types of biases or priming effects, you will try to do that. And that gets you closer to where you want to be. So it's almost the idea that you find in psychology sometimes, that these kind of overly positive ideas of ourselves have this self-fulfilling factor. You know, they're almost like self-fulfilling prophecies. Because I want to be the rational deliberator, I will try and behave in a way so that I can become a rational deliberator. There are, of course, problems with this picture. It's not so easy. You know, it's not enough that we want to be in a certain way. We also need to have the capacities that are necessary to behave rationally. But I think that, you know, if we are considering costs and benefits, there are costs like epistemic inaccuracy and possibly this idea that we may become complacent with ourselves. But there are also benefits that it has this kind of motivation. It's a motivation machine. It's kind of a propeller. It kind of invites us to keep on aiming really high.
Mm-hmm. So since you mentioned self-fulfilling prophecies, and we are talking about self-narratives, we tend to associate people that are more pessimistic with them being more realistic, more intelligent, more sharper. Can pessimism and sadness and things like that be things that are obstacles in our way to for us to become functional people, even though we might be more epistemically rational?
That's an extremely interesting issue, I think. And philosophers have recognized that the literature on depressive realism is fascinating, exactly for that reason. The kind of engagement with that type of literature is one of the reasons that I got to the notion of epistemic innocence, or at least one of the reasons why I decided to apply it to the optimism bias literature. So the kind of description that I was offering to you before, this idea of the redemption narrative or the overly positive sense of self, applies to people who do not have a diagnosis of clinical depression. So it's quite widespread in a non-clinical population. People with depressive symptoms are much less likely to have positive views of themselves, as you were saying. They're much more realistic. Initially, we thought they might be pessimistic, so they have a negative bias, the opposite type of bias. But some findings at some point suggested that no, actually, you know, they track reality much better. So they are realists and we are optimists. That's also not completely uncontroversial. So what some people now say about the depressive realism literature is that people with some depressive symptoms, for instance, people with low mood, tend to be more accurate, but just in the context of their own self-evaluations. So when they're thinking about themselves, not when they're thinking about other people or when they're thinking about external reality as divorced from themselves. But people with major depression, where you know the depression reaches some kind of clinical threshold, they do have a negative bias. So it's not so much that they are realistic, but they have the opposite type of bias as the bias that we tend to have when we don't have any such symptoms. So, you know, things are kind of complicated again. So you'd see that in order to be epistemically rational and have an accurate evaluation of ourselves, we need to be not clinically depressed, but, you know, kind of pretty low mood, as you were saying. So what we normally define as pessimistic, like in the kind of lay language. Is that good or bad? It's complicated. So It might seem, just by a superficial reading of the book, that I'm actually suggesting that being optimist is always better. And why it may seem that way? Because what I point to is that optimism may give you extra motivation to overcome obstacles and fulfill your goals. So it gives you more chances of success. It doesn't translate directly into success, but it gives you more chances of success, even with your epistemic goals. And indeed, the psychological literature suggests that being mildly optimistic is actually good for a number of things: productivity, mastery, control, altruism even, and capacity to overcome things like crisis in a relationship or health scares like cancer, for instance, or being HIV positive and so on. So, you know, that seems good. At the same time, there are types of optimism that are not good. So the type of optimism that is good is when you recognize the problem, you acknowledge the threat, but you think you have the capacity to cope with the threat because you think you are better than you actually are. So that's where the optimism kicks in. And so what the good type of optimism does, it changes your behavior. It modifies your behavior for the better. The bad type of optimism is the kind of optimism that is blind to the problems. So you are denying that there is any issue. Your mood keeps being really good initially, but actually you don't change your behavior because you don't think there is any reason to do so, and you end up not being as successful. So bad type of optimism leads to risk taking. Imagine the smoker who denies that lung cancer, you know, may be an option for him in the future, and therefore he decides, I'm not going to quit smoking, right? So that type of behavior, when your optimism is kind of denying rather than acknowledging the threat. That said, there is one sense in which the good type of optimism may become epistemically good overall. And there are two ways in which this can happen, either via the self-fulfilling prophecy that we talked about. So you imagine a scenario which is better than it actually is because of your overly positive self-evaluations. And by doing that, you change your behavior so that actually you become the better version of yourself that you initially thought you were, and therefore you make it more likely that the good scenario becomes real. So that's one option. I think it's an interesting option, but I don't think it applies to very many contexts. I think, you know, it's we have to be careful in trying and extend it too much. The other option is what we were discussing at the beginning. What if the irrationality is just a ladder, you know, is just an intermediate step? So your initial optimism makes you behave in a certain way. You get to develop this resilience, and then you are ready to kind of acknowledge what the extent of the threat may be. You become more realistic, but you don't lose the resilience. You don't lose this capacity to modify your behavior for the better. And I think in some contexts, that's what we should aim for. We should aim to keep enough optimism to give us the change in behavior that we need, which may be difficult to obtain if we didn't have the motivation that comes from optimism, but then realize that optimism is actually just a strategy. So realize that there is this kind of instrumental role to it. Mm-hmm. I think maybe philosophers could do that. You know, people who are very reflective about what they do, you know, could actually get to a point where they realize that optimism is like a way of thinking that is good for them, but is not actually how the world is. So they realize that, you know, it's a strategy to get to where they want to be.
Mm-hmm. So when people have these sort of good optimism, I mean, the one that you just described, where they get good results by believing certain good things about themselves and that they are able to do something or to achieve something, for example. Couldn't we say that at least some of the beliefs that are produced by that good optimism are epistemically rational in a way? Because I mean, since people are sort of dealing with reality, and by behaving in that way they are able to produce good results, Wouldn't, at least from a pragmatic perspective, these beliefs be epistemically rational because they produce good results?
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. So the way I'd like to describe this case is to say, okay, maybe they are still epistemically rational just because, let me explain, just because when you're actually forming the belief at that point, just prior to the adoption of the belief, you don't actually have the evidence that supports that belief content. So they may start out as being epistemically irrational. But then, by changing our behavior, by contributing to our motivation, they create, they contribute to creating a reality that matches the content of the belief better. So they may start as being ill-grounded, let's say, but then they may end up being supported by the evidence in the end. So there is a process there. So that's one thing that you could say. The epistemic rationality changes across time, and it improves. Another thing that you may say, I imagine some philosophers who want to say this, look, theoretically, they're still irrational. But as you were saying, practically or pragmatically, they're actually a rational belief to have for the agent because it leads the agents where the agents wants to be. So there are different ways in which we could capture the phenomenon that you're describing, and I'm quite sympathetic to that.
Should we label irrational beliefs that are the result of some sort of mental illness or mental disorder irrational? I mean, because I would imagine that perhaps in that kind of situation, they wouldn't be neither rational or irrational. They're just the product of some sort of mental issue that the person has, or am I thinking wrongly?
That's a good question. So, as you know, some people think that when a mental state is part of what we call a mental disorder, so something like schizophrenia or dementia, to the point that it becomes a symptom of it. So, it's part of the reason why clinicians diagnose people with those disorders. Then we shouldn't really talk about those mental states as, okay, there are several things people say. We shouldn't talk about them as beliefs at all. We shouldn't talk about them as rational or irrational, which I think is a related idea. Some people go even farther than that. They say we shouldn't consider them as meaningful mental states even. They're just noises or utterances, but with no particular meaning, that they are not understandable. I want to resist that very strongly, and I've done that in most of my work. And I'm just going to give you a few reasons for that. The reason I want to resist that is that take the case of delusion, which is one symptom of schizophrenia, dementia, and other disorders. Sometimes these delusions are things that people say with some conviction, and they keep saying, sometimes for months or years. They sound extremely strange. So, for instance, they might say, I don't know, I'm dead, or my mother is being replaced by an imposter, or there is a nuclear reactor inside me. So, the reason why I'm saying they're strange is that the content is not just false, but we cannot imagine there being sufficient evidence for them to adopt that belief, or the content is even impossible, like physically impossible. How can there be a nuclear reactor inside yourself? There's just not enough space, that kind of thing. So, certainly, I can understand why some philosophers want to say, why are you treating them just like other beliefs? They don't seem to work like other beliefs at all. They don't have the same relationship with evidence. They are not abundant when there is counter evidence and so on. But the thing is, they are not empty utterances. Like, they're not just noises. Because when you look carefully at how those beliefs are formed, and when you look carefully at the content of the belief and how it relates to the person's life, you actually realize that they make a lot of sense, surprisingly. So one way of putting it, if you've got the radical interpretation framework a la Quine-Davidson, a very well-informed interpreter doesn't find them that irrational. So in the case, for instance, of things like Cotard or Capgras syndrome, where the person thinks they're dead or they think that someone has been replaced by an imposter, they have an anomalous experience that actually suggests that that is a likely explanation of that experience. So in the case of believing that you are dead, let's just use that example, the person experiences a change in the, all of their experience, not just in parts of it. They feel detached, nothing excites them, nothing bothers them, they feel like things are not happening to them, they feel they cannot intervene in external reality. And this radical change of their experience calls for a radical explanation. Now, obviously, the explanation that they're dead is not plausible. It's almost self-defeating, because if they're dead, you know, why are they thinking or talking about their beliefs? But the kind of experience, it would be really difficult to explain otherwise, unless, you know, they were convinced that they had a mental disorder. And similarly, with the case of some people feeling persecuted or feeling that God is talking to them or giving them a special mission, there is often something in the content of their delusion that makes sense if you know about their previous experiences. Maybe they've been bullied, you know, in their workplace, or maybe they've been abused as children and they have developed some kind of defense mechanism by which, you know, now they are really important because God wants them to do things. So what I'm saying is that when you actually put the belief, let's call it not a belief because we don't want to give the game away, but when you put the mental state into context, or the utterance in the context of that person's life and that person's experience, is no longer ununderstandable. And it plays many of the functional roles of a belief, because, you know, it's true that people do not give up delusions easily, but they are sensitive to evidence in some way. So if you tell someone with a delusion what you believe is not likely to be true, and you give them reasons, they will react to it. They will recognize what you say as a piece of a challenge or counter evidence, and they will either elaborate their belief in response to that, or they will explain to you why is it that, yes, it's true, it's implausible, but it's actually happening to me, right? So there is this kind of game that they're playing, which is exactly the game that we play when we are defending our beliefs. So I think it makes sense to call them as beliefs, although I see the reasons of the people who don't want to do the same. Now, the question is, are they rational or irrational? They're just, you know, are rational, so that rationality doesn't apply to them. Now, I think if they are beliefs, then we are justified in asking questions about what the relationship with evidence is. And although they are, as I was saying, irresponsive to evidence, because it's very likely that they are abandoned in the face of challenges, they are also sensitive to evidence in the way I was describing. And very often there is evidence on the basis of which they've been adopted. For instance, these anomalous experiences. So I don't see the calling them rational or irrational a problem. But what I would want to say is that if we call them, you know, if we want to apply the notion of rationality to them, we will have to end up saying that they are irrational because they don't meet, for instance, responsiveness to evidence in the case of delusion. And then I think a more interesting question is to say, what is this irrationality like? I mean, is it the same irrationality as, you know, climate change denial or vaccine hesitancy or, you know, some other irrational beliefs that we might have, or the positive illusions about ourselves that we were talking about earlier, or is it a different type of irrationality? And my view is that it's the same type of irrationality. It's a form of epistemic irrationality. But it's certainly possible that in some cases of delusion, the irrationality is manifested to a greater extent than in other cases. So we've got a quantitative difference, maybe, but not a qualitative difference in the type of irrationality that is manifested.
Mm-hmm. What about religious beliefs? Would these fall under the rubric of irrationality or not?
It's a very big question. So there is a very interesting literature, empirical literature, on the question whether there is a difference between, let's say, religious beliefs and delusions with religious content. So you know, why is it that when someone says, you know, Jesus was talking to me this morning through the breeze that was going through the trees, we think that they are deluded or schizophrenic or whatever. But when someone expresses some religious beliefs that are accepted by a religious community, we think that they are just religious believers. So that's a very interesting question. And people who have clinical experience see that, you may say that there are important differences. The possibly the most significant difference is what I've just explained, the role of the community. So in the case of the religious believer, what happened who is not deluded, let's say, or at least has not been diagnosed with a delusion, the idea is that most of their beliefs will be shared by a community, not maybe by the whole society, that's fine, but there will be a community for which those beliefs make sense and those beliefs are considered to be true. And there will be social support. So those beliefs may actually be central to the person's identity and social life in some cases. In the case of the delusion, the belief ends up being very idiosyncratic. So the person with delusion doesn't normally have a community that accepts that kind of belief as true or as plausible. And so there is an ensuing social isolation that I think contributes to the harmful or disruptive nature of delusion. So that's one important difference. I think another important difference that philosophers tend to forget about, because, you know, we don't see patients, we just work with people who see patients in the best of cases, is that the delusion never happens in isolation. So it's not that the person, you know, comes to the attention of a psychiatrist because they have this unusual belief and that's it. They normally come to the attention of psychiatrists because they've been extremely preoccupied, they've lacked sleep, they've lost their jobs, they've interrupted any contact with their families and friends, they started behaving in ways that were not socially acceptable. So is this kind of accompanying behavior to the delusion that it often contributes to a diagnosis rather than the content of the delusion itself in isolation from everything else? So that's just beginning to answer your question, that there may be features that distinguish religious beliefs from religious delusions or delusions with religious content. I don't think that we should say that beliefs for which some forms of evidence doesn't seem to apply are necessarily irrational. So I think we have lots of beliefs, not just religious beliefs, for which it's very difficult to find obvious relevant evidence, right? So should we say that they are all irrational? No, I think they're different types of beliefs. I mean, some people suggest that actually the category of belief may just be too broad to be helpful, and we should just distinguish between types of beliefs. So there are types of beliefs for which the evidence plays this very important defining role, right? And so we call them epistemically rational or irrational, depending on how they relate to the evidence. And some beliefs that, you know, for which that doesn't apply. For instance, beliefs at a very high level of abstraction, where it's very difficult to think about one piece of evidence that either confirms them or disconfirms them. So it's difficult to say, you know, are religious beliefs irrational in this kind of general way, because there is so much more that we want to know. But I, you know, that's not the claim I would like to make. That's not a claim I would like to make. Or yeah.
Mm-hmm. So since we talked here a little bit about mental disorders, can this approach, I mean, what you call at a certain point in the book, the Epistemic Innocence Project, help us informing and improving clinical practices?
Okay, that's the hope. That's the aspiration, the hubris of the philosopher, that he can actually make a positive change to real life. That's a part of the optimism bias, probably. But yes, that's exactly what I was trying to do in the book. These kind of changes take a lot of time, so it's difficult to know what will happen and whether, you know, ultimately I'll be successful. But that's definitely one idea that I had. So very briefly, my idea was this. When you look at definitions in the clinical literature and the psychological literature of delusions or confabulation or distorted memory, most of them are definitions that are based on the epistemic features of these mental states. So they say things like these mental states are false, or they are upheld against evidence, or they are fixed, and so on. Which is fair enough. The reason being that, you know, the cognitive scientists, clinical and academic psychiatrists haven't actually found a consensus on the kind of theological theories that would explain this kind of belief. So they cannot define them on the basis of the mechanisms that are responsible for them, because there is not enough consensus on that. But if you are going to offer a definition that is epistemic, so based on how the belief, let's say, manifests itself in behavior, then I think you should consider both the costs and the benefits. So I think it is just a partial account that we find in the literature about these kind of phenomena, an account that is primarily negative. It tells us what these beliefs cannot do and what kind of negative effects they have. And they are truthful in that, I think. You know, they are supported by evidence, but they are not the complete picture. They are not the full picture. So what I am suggesting is that we should think about the benefits as well. And if we think about the benefits, then we have a better rounded, more balanced account of what these beliefs do. Because it is true that delusions are disruptive, but shouldn't we ask ourselves whether they are the cause of the disruption or whether they are a response to an existing disruption? And many cognitive scientists now see the benefit in thinking that delusions are actually adaptive responses to a problem that the person is experiencing, starting from the anomalous experience, for instance, that is extremely distressing, and it may become paralyzing if it's not actually explained in some way. So the delusions comes up as part of a disorder, maybe even as caused by the presence of a disorder, if we want to talk about disorders in this context, but it's not overall a negative phenomenon. It's a way for the person to cope with a reality that is slipping away and is extremely difficult to manage. Similarly, if you're thinking about psychological situations where the person has no resources to cope with what is happening to them because the trauma is just too overwhelming, the delusion may come as a temporary way to accept a better version of reality until the person is ready to accept reality as it is. So I'm thinking that epistemic innocence is putting the emphasis on the benefits. It's not denying the costs, but it's putting the emphasis on the fact that there may also be, not in every case, but in some cases, in some significant cases, positive things that the belief is doing. And if we think that that's the case, then the way in which we manage these symptoms should also change. It's not longer the truth that the challenge, the direct challenge and confrontation that some patients experience when they report beliefs should be the way, the default way in which we react to those beliefs. We may acknowledge that the belief has a positive role to play, and so allow the patient to experience the positive sides of that belief until they're positive. And then when the patient is ready to think about replacing the belief with something that is more epistemically rational, that's the way that we do it. But basically seeing the delusion not as a glitch, not as a consequence of a little bit of damage that needs to be fixed, but as something that has meaning for the person who is reporting it, as costs, very significant psychological costs, but may also play an important function. And I think these may actually change the way we think about delusions and people who have severe mental illness, less stigmatizing way of thinking about them, and the way we deal with them. We tackle their problems, we help them and support them in getting better.
Mm-hmm. Do we have time for two more questions or yes?
Sure.
Okay, great. So, because I would like to ask you about romantic relationships specifically. You spend some time in the book talking about that and the biases associated with them. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. So I would like to say, first of all, that there is a lot of research on this particular topic, whether an optimistic attitude is beneficial to romantic relationships, and that things are changing very quickly. So the kind of picture that I may offer may become outdated very, very soon. But the current evidence suggests that some forms of optimism may actually be good for the relationship, in the sense that may make the relationship more satisfying and more stable. And this is based on studies that have been done with couples who were recently married, so they knew each other, but they and not been in a stable relationship for a long time. And what has been noticed is that people who had an over-idealized conception of their partners, so they thought that their partners were better than average in a number of things, maybe more attractive, cleverer, and so on, also experienced a better relationship. The idea of this really calls back to the idea of the self-fulfilling prophecy. So when I think of my partner as someone who is actually very good in a number of ways, my partner will try and satisfy that picture somehow to fulfill those expectations. And so their behavior will improve across time, and they will become more similar to my ideal partner than they were at the beginning. So again, reality is changing to match the belief. One thing that is quite important is that this kind of idea that your partner is better than other people and your relationship is actually better than other people's relationship is part of this optimism bias and has been thought to have important evolutionary stories. So it's actually the idea that some positive illusions have been selected because in our past, in a competitive environment, it was very important to be able to keep your partner close to you so that they could defend the offsprings from danger. So the stable relationship was going to be good for your genes eventually, and for your survival and reproduction and survival and reproduction of your children. So the idea is that these kind of positive illusions are actually adaptive, even in a biological sense. But my point in the book is just that they may actually be good for you psychologically because they may actually give some kind of illustration of the idea that once you've got a certain goal, and by keeping the motivation to reach the goal because you value the goal, you may actually be able to overcome some difficulties. Obviously, they require some irrationality. So, you know, sometimes it has been found that, let's say, my evaluation of my partner is even more positive than my partner's evaluation of himself, which is kind of interesting. So the kind of the bias that you have towards the people that you care about, usually partners and children, actually is even more strong than the bias that you have when you are thinking about yourself as better than you are. But it's an extension of it. And I think it's part of our kind of social life, how we make relationships and how we maintain them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just one last question. I've already asked you about improving clinical practices. Does this approach of epistemic innocence of irrational beliefs help us better understand how our, let's say, quote-unquote, normal cognition works?
Yes, and again, ideally, one aspiration of the book is to inspire cognitive scientists to try and verify some of my wildly speculative claims, right? So it would actually be very good and I think important if there was a project looking at some of our irrational beliefs and see what kind of effects they have. The kind of claims that I made are based on some evidence, but the evidence wasn't actually gathered for the purposes of showing the benefits of irrational beliefs. And so it's just partial. And it requires a lot of interpretation and a lot of guessing. And I think what would be really nice is to see whether we can find some confirmation of the idea that some of these irrational beliefs contribute to our epistemic life as agents in a positive way. I think if we found that that's the case, I think that would contribute to an understanding of normal cognition because it would be almost like a vindication of our irrationality. So we know from the 60s all this evidence showing that there are systematic reasoning mistakes in the way that we reason and in the way we make predictions about the future and the way in which we evaluate certain situations. And the reaction of philosophers has been always very kind of apologetic. No, that's not true. We are actually rational. It's the experimenters who took the wrong rational standards and so on. I've never been like that. I've always thought, no, okay, what they're showing is important. There are limitations. But that's not the end of the story. You know, once we recognize the limitations, there is a lot that we can do within those limitations, but there is also a lot that we can do to try and overcome those limitations. So knowledge of the limitations is actually power because it may actually allow us to develop strategies that will not be natural to us, but will be hard work, quite a lot of effort, to try and make sure that our reasoning improves, our decision making improves, even, you know, considering those limitations. So I guess the idea of the book is irrationality is something we need to embrace and acknowledge, because that's the only way that we can try to overcome it in a positive way, while continuing to kind of enjoy the benefits they might give us in the meantime.
Okay, so just before we go, where can people find your work on the internet?
Okay, so I run a blog which is called Imperfect Cognitions, and there is quite a lot about the Epistemic Innocence Project in there, as long as lots of other interesting things. The book has been published in June, and there has been a virtual book launch due to the global pandemic. So everything is available open access online. There are six researchers from all over the world talking about the book, challenging the book. And I've also developed a response on the Brains blog, where I've had a series of posts on the book. So there is, you know, if you're interested, there are lots of places that are completely open access, free to look at, where you can read more about what I'm trying to do with the book.
Okay, great. So guys, again, the book is The Epistemic Innocence of Irrational Beliefs, and Dr. Bortolotti, great. Dr. Bortolotti, thank you for coming on the show. It was a real pleasure to have you.
I had a great time. Thank you, Riccardo. Thank you very much.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've started this channel back in February 2018 and have been putting out regular interviews with top academics and scholars from a variety of fields. So to keep the channel sustainable, I would like to ask you to please pay a visit to my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. If you prefer PayPal, I also have links to that in the description box of the video. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please leave a like, share it, and hit the subscription button. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litske and Blanchett Perga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunda, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Kessel, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Anian Kata, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollacy, Eric Alenius, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetriou, Robert Windegger, Rui Inácio, Arthur Coe, Zoop, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Jugni, Alexander Dunbauer, Omri Hickson, Fergal Cusson, Yevan Bodrenko, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Don Ross, João Alves da Silva, Jonathan Librant, Oslem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, JW, João Eira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yassil Adeza Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, and Yannick Punter. My producers, Izar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stafiniak, Ian Gilligan, Sergio Codriano, Luis Caetano, Matthew Lavender, Tom Van Egdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Giddy, Sardis France, and Niruban Balachandran. And my executive producers, Michel Rujewski, Rosie, and James Pratt. Thank you for all.